Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a show about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am Reggie Darden, and I have another wonderful guest with me today. I have the one and only Tony Capone with me, and we're going to get into his story, his journey, how the martial arts and Kenpo found him, and we'll just kind of go from there. I usually kick things off with just a brief background. I have trained in a number of martial arts, Kenpo, Capoeira, Hapkido, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai. I did some boxing. So I'm pretty busy. But we may get into more of my items as we go along. But I'm going to turn it over to my esteemed guest here. And How did... where did it all start for you? And we'll just kind of go from there.
Okay. Well, it actually started when I was in high school on the wrestling team. And to get better, I used to go over to the junior college and wrestle with the college guys over there in the evening when they would practice all the time. And it would be like an open mat thing for them guys wrestling. And I went over there one night and there was a judo class going on, and I kind of started watching it, and the instructor, who was at that time Jack Williams, a third degree in Kodokan judo, and he had trained in Japan, spoke Japanese fluently, had a Japanese wife, and the guy was about 5'6", and I was just, again, one of those stories where you watch this little guy just like tossing people all over the place and stuff like that, and I says, wow, I got to do this. And so after I got done with the wrestling thing and after his class, I approached him and asked him, and he told me that you had to be a student at the college to go ahead and take his class. And I was a little disappointed, but the next week when I went back, he was there with his class again, and I was wrestling, and I went up and approached him again and asked him if he could make an exception. And after about three tries, he did. And I started training in judo. And the next year, I actually did become a student there. And I trained for about 2 years under Jack Williams. And it was really funny because back then, judo wasn't the judo of today. At least that's not the way I see it. Hell, our first 2 years, we were on the ground jiu-jitsuing each other before we actually started throwing people around and doing the throws and things like that. So like the Brazilian jiu-jitsu of today, a lot of that stuff, it was Japanese jiu-jitsu, and then they, I guess, took their name to it and refined it and did whatever they did. But that's how I started. And then I spent about 2 years there and got my brown belt. And then in 1971, this movie called Billy Jack came out.
Oh, yes. And, very familiar with that
everybody,
one.
Yeah. So I saw that and I says, oh, I got to do this karate thing. And I went home and looked in the yellow pages, and growing up in Hialeah, there was a lot of judo clubs and stuff, but there wasn't a lot of karate things going on. But I did find an ad for Tracy's Karate, and they at the time were using Joe Lewis as their poster boy. And so I joined the local Tracy's school at Hialeah, who it was owned by Tom Dunn, who at the time was a third degree black belt in Tracy's Kenpo, and he owned about three or four different schools. At that time, he wound up getting about seven before he finally finished. But I started training in Tracy's and trained with them until a little after I got my black belt in 1974. We had a little falling out because I didn't want to run one of his schools. I just wanted to train. So I decided to do something else. And I was at a tournament. And when I got done with the tournament, an old high school guy that I used to know named Steve McKelvin, who was on the gymnastics team, he started commenting to me about my form and stuff like that. And we were talking, and I didn't even know he did martial arts, but he turned out he did, and he was in Shotokan. And so he invited me over to his school over at the Mall Lake Marina, which was like a big boatyard, and you went in one of these warehouses, and there was a big wooden floor there, just like old school stuff. And we went in there, and I started training with him for a little while, and he really showed me how to perform a form and how to do a form in the hardcore stuff that he was doing in the Shotokan style. And I kind of really dug it for a while, And I trained with him for a while. I also trained in Goju-Ryu with a guy named Steve Beattie, who was a one-time student of Johnny Pachivas. And I trained with him for a couple of years also. So I just kind of kicked around and did a bunch of different things. I even did some old school Taekwondo, which back in the early 70s, mid 70s was a lot different than the Taekwondo you see today. So that's where we were at, and that's how I got started. And I trained for a while, and then I finally took a little break, and at one point I became a bouncer, and that's where you really learn whether your stuff works or doesn't work and how you can change and do things and adopt it to the street. So anyway, that's kind of how I got started.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Now, to go back to the transition from judo to Kenpo, was that a big difference? Did you have to relearn everything, or was it fairly easy transition?
Yeah, yes and no, because even though the judo had like a temiwaza and some striking in it that Jack Williams taught, it was just a whole different ball game from what I had done the Kenpo stuff. And even the Kenpo back then, it was a little bit more about all the fighting and not so much about the techniques and things like that that we have today.
Let's see here. I kind of lost my train there. Just to make sure it
we were talking about the transition from judo to karate, right?
Yeah. And then I guess along those lines, so doing the other styles, the Shotokan and the Goju-Ryu and such, was there a learning curve or difficulty in training with those other systems as well? Or
no, not really. I kind of feel that after I left Kenpo and started the Japanese systems, to me they were easy compared to what the Kenpo was and stuff like that. And I found it kind of easy to make the transition from the Kenpo, the way we did things in Tracy's Kenpo, to the Goju-Ryu or Shotokan styles. And I kind of dug it because those guys were hard hitters. They were, you know, badass, and they liked to fight. And I think that the hardcore way that they trained, as opposed to, even though we trained hard in Kenpo, wasn't quite the same. I think that that kind of helped later as I put everything together, especially after I became a bouncer. It was just a harder core way of training that helped me in those situations. And I think that that's some of the things that might be missing even in today's world. So.
Okay. And so how did the bouncing, start off? And
well, it was just a job.
How did you get into it?
Like I say, I had a friend of mine that worked there, and, I was looking for a job, and so I decided to go ahead and do that. And it turned out to be a lot of fun, you know, and also a lot of fighting. I mean, it was a country and western bar. It was almost like the place that Patrick Swayze worked in before he got there. You know, blood on the floor every night. You know, it is just, you know, we had 10-cent drink nights, and we had free beer Wednesday nights, you know, and just all kinds of crazy stuff. And of course, those corn-fed rednecks, they'd come in and get pretty drunk up and didn't really want to take any orders when we told them it was time to go. Or, you know, there was a lot of fights, and you know how things go like that and stuff. So, but it was different for sure, because you really got to see what does work, what doesn't work. Fighting in close quarters, you know, we're so used to sparring on mats, and we're so used to going into a dojo and doing things. And it was a lot different when you're fighting between two cars, or fighting with 30 people standing around you and bar stools, or a hallway, or even in the bathroom, you know, just things like that. So I think that that was a big factor in learning about how to fight really on the street, is fighting out of the dojo on a street surface, or just in a different environment.
Now, when you got the job, was there kind of some desire to test your skills, or
Well, of
did
course.
you just kind of fall into the job? And
Yeah, no,
well,
I was
that's
a
kind of
real
one of the
I was a
things
real
with
Yeah, no,
oh,
I
go
was
ahead.
a real asshole, and I tried to start every fight I could. I didn't really back down too much, and I was pretty confident in my skills, and I kind of learned that you could really do pretty good. I mean, if you trained and you trained hard before, and then you got into this type of environment, that fighting untrained people was not that much of a problem, even two or three at a time. So it was just a different thing back then too. I'm talking about late 70s, real early 80s. And it was just a different type of environment. And yes, you do learn what does work and what doesn't work and things like that. So
So you are in a interesting position in that a lot of people that train the martial arts, and there's a lot of back and forth about, oh, well, what works in the street, what doesn't work in the street, if you're gonna, grab, all the fights, go to the ground, all. So you are in the unique position in that you've experienced having trained in both the ground and the grappling and the upright striking, and in a very real world scenario. What are maybe some misconceptions or just kind of things that we're kind of arguing about that you've actually had the real perspective on? What are maybe some things, at least as far as your viewpoint? We're not gonna say that, oh, well, yeah, it's always this way, or it always works out that the fights always go to the ground or anything like that. But just kind of in your experience, maybe what is maybe some of the misconceptions or maybe even some things that maybe people aren't taking into consideration in these kind of real world scenarios that maybe you've experienced or kind of seen.
Well, I guess one of the first misconceptions I guess I'll address is the 99% of the fights go to the ground thing. I know that the Gracies use that as a great marketing concept for their art. And the thing was that what most people don't know is that those statistics that they used to tell you that 95 or 90 or whatever percent went to the ground was actually from police officers and law enforcement. And of course, what do? You get a guy, you put him on the ground and you handcuff him, or you do whatever you have to do. And of course, 99% go to the ground. But in real life, one thing I noticed that when I was a bouncer, and I had a conversation with Mr. Pick one time about this, and he said the same thing I did. Sorry about that.
No problem.
My dog,
No
Daisy.
problem. I've got a couple of myself, so no worries.
And so anyway, we had that conversation about going to the ground 95% of the time. And I told him that when I was a bouncer, I never went to the ground one time on all the fights that we had. And man, we used to have three and four and six a night or whatever. Like I said, that place was crazy. And I think that if people learned how to maybe sprawl, learned a couple of good basic jujitsu stuff, that I think that they could probably handle themselves without the 15-year jujitsu training. Just like anything, listen, you can train for 10 minutes and be pretty good at something, and you can train just to fight or just to do this. There's a whole art side to the martial arts also. So, but I think that's the first misconception. Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that everybody talks about. And the jujitsu guys, right. The jiu-jitsu guys are adamant about going to the ground, and everything goes, and that's okay. I don't listen. I'm 71 years old now. I can't afford to go to the ground. So I'm hoping that I can still sprawl my fat ass out of the way a little bit and get a couple of good shots in. And if you know how to hit, and, if you spent some time on the Makuwari and you did stuff and you have heavy hands, you can probably, even though the guy is a decent jujitsu guy, you still might be able to prevent him from taking you down with a couple of good shots, because they do train and they train hard and they're tough guys, but they don't get hit in the face a lot and they don't get hit in the head and things like that. And I'm not saying that that's the be all of anything. It's not. I'm just saying that if you train right, and we go into this all the time, it's not the style. Whoops. You there? Okay. It's not the style. It's the artist. So a good jiu-jitsu guy can take anybody. A good taekwondo guy can take pretty much anybody. A good kempo guy can, you know what I mean?
Back on track. There are little technical difficulties, but we'll get this pieced back in. So we were talking about the kind of real world scenarios just kind of to recap from your perspective, the fights don't always go to the ground or don't usually go to the ground as many like to claim. From your perspective, what about things like dealing with multiple attackers? Is it always kind of just the one guy, or do you always have to deal with a person and their buddies, and kind of how do those scenarios go, at least as far as you've seen?
Right. Well, nowadays you always have to deal with the guy's buddies. You just never know what to expect. Hell, even his girlfriend will come and smack you in the head with something if you're not careful. You know, that's just the way it is nowadays. Even back in the old days, she used to listen to me like I'm 1,000 years old. But, even 40, 50 years ago, whatever it was, you had to always be aware of the other person jumping in, or the friends jumping in, or even just getting chapped by a couple of guys just right off. I just think that that's gotten even a little bit more nowadays than it was. Back in those days, you just always have to do that. And really, you have to just think about that when you're training for Kempo. In Kempo, that we've got lots of techniques and lots of stuff, but when it gets right down to it, is can you move? Can you move fast? Are you aware of your surroundings? What are you doing? Can you use your environment? Sometimes the environment can help. If you're between two cars and there's multiple attackers, you might be able to use that to shut off the other guy from getting you by keeping that guy in between, the first guy in between. There's a lot of things you can do. It's always strategy that you can discuss and think about, which we try to cover whenever we train. That's what my take on that is anyway. Always be aware of the other guy. And then also, of course, when multiple attackers are going to happen, sometimes you get a confrontation with a couple of guys and you know it's not going to end well. You just know you're not getting out of it well. Then you know what, you got to go Cobra Kai on them. Strike hard, strike fast, and I always say strike first, okay? Then you have the no mercy, okay? But strike hard, strike fast, and strike first, and I always believe that on the street, power is king. It really is. If you can't hit hard, then you're just going to be popping the guy a million times and he's just going to kick your ass. It's just as simple as that. You have to be able to hit, and you have to be able to hurt, and you have to hit in the right places, and you have to get there fast. Again, I'm talking back in those days, it was different because I was a little younger. I could afford to maybe let something go a little bit more. But nowadays, and even in these times, and not just me being an old man, but even guys like you that are young guys, you have to be aware of that kind of stuff, and you have to make the decision of whether you should pull the trigger first or try and do the right thing and let the guy swing on you and then defend yourself. Sometimes that doesn't always work, You know, sometimes you have to go ahead and take the initiative when you know that there is no value, you know, way to get out of it. Then you have to take the initiative. You know, it's one of those, if you can't get out of it, then get into it. That's always been one of my favorites. And you kind of know that after a while that it's just not going to go well. You know, you try to talk to the guy, you try to calm them down, you try to ask what's happened. And it's happened several times to me, and just nothing is going to go well. So you know what? Take the initiative. Now, the one thing I have on my favor that you don't, or that a lot of people don't, is that I'm an old guy. So when the cops get there, I can always say, you know, hobble away and say, that old son of a bitch tried to beat my ass. I'm just an old man. And, you know, I play the old man's card, and sometimes that works pretty good. But when you guys are younger, like you guys, you can't do that. So you got to make sure you do what you got to do and get the hell out of there before they have a chance to search the cameras, you know, and do stuff like that. So, but that's my thing on that. And the whole multiple thing is just basically, you got to be aware. And then if you have to, you got to pull the trigger first, because if you can take one person out, then you only got one or two more left to deal with or whatever. So that's kind of my philosophy on that.
Very nice. Very nice. So to kind of keep on this theme of your real world experience, what about weapons? You have to deal with, taking people out with weapons, whether you had one or they had one, or how did those kind of situations go?
Well, I've always gotten lucky. It's funny. My wife is sitting here. She was at the bar one night when a guy came back to kill me with a gun. And what had happened was the week before, he had pulled a girl's top down or something like that. So I had to toss him out. And he went across the street and he bought a big giant kitchen knife at the department store across the street. And it was about 1:30 in the morning, and I was sitting in the chair facing away from the door, which was something I've never done since then. And a buddy of mine we were having a conversation, and all of a sudden I saw his eyes light up, and I jumped out of the chair, and that guy came down and he hit that chair with the knife and just did miss me, thank goodness. And I wound up throwing him out and beating his eye, and got the cops, and they got involved. And a few weeks later, he came back to shoot me. And Linda, my wife, was there, and she goes, you know, that guy's staring at you, Tony. And I says, I understand. I know. Let me go start it with him before he starts it with me. And sure enough, he wound up having a gun under his shirt, and I did start it with him, and I took the initiative before it started, and I got him just as he was starting to pull it out, and I got lucky again, and wound up having him arrested and stuff like that. And then there was a few times where there was knives involved, and I got a whole thing about knives. The Kempo knife techniques are there to teach you principles and concepts. I'm not sure if they're really viable on the street. Some Krav Maga would help, and just another way of looking at things. The Filipino martial arts are good to a point. Everything's good. And I think that I got lucky all the times that there were knives pulled on me. I got lucky. Not that I was that good, but that those guys were that bad. They were either drunk, they didn't know how to use a knife, things like that. You know, the environment was in my favor. I may have had something to whack them with. Who knows? Again, like I say, our knife techniques in the Kempo system, they're kind of there for something different rather than real self-defense. So, I mean, I think the Krav Maga offers a few things. I think there's a lot of guys out there that are offering good stuff against weapons that may not be Kempo or judo or this or that or whatever. They're just good old-fashioned kick your ass knife techniques that will work, stuff like the military might use. The problem with some of that stuff is we can't train it, because nowadays we have lawyers and we have things, and you know, you got to be careful about getting hurt in class and things like that. So a lot of things aren't really addressed as much as they could be because of that situation. But that's what I feel about that. Just have a good solid blocks, good solid technique, and I think that you'll be okay. But you got to train it. You got to train it hard.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. I think that's something that maybe doesn't get talked about enough or focused on enough with. So there is the debate about, we'll just kind of keep it on the Kenpo side, but there is the camp of folks that think that the gun and knife defenses in Kenpo are pretty worthless, and then there's some that say that, you know, they're the greatest thing ever. But I think a part of it that doesn't get focused on is that many of the opponents that you're going to be dealing with, and you mentioned this, is that they don't know how to use. They may have a knife or a gun or something, but they don't know how to use it. Versus the Kenpoist that has some, you know, some experience with it. Okay, a particular knife defense or gun defense may not be all that great, you know, on paper, so to speak, but just the fact that you have some experience with it versus someone that has no experience with it, that gives you the advantage. And for me personally, I've never really thought super highly of knife and gun defenses in any martial art, not just Kenpo. Some, you know, like the Filipino martial arts, because that's kind of more of what they do. I think that they're maybe have a little bit more of an advantage. But I've never really personally thought that. I mean, it's pretty easy to get cut up with a knife, and it's not like the movies where you can, you know, do this, you know, fancy block, or, you know, kick the knife out of their hand, or, you know, things like that. But yeah, there's definitely more aspects to them than just kind of how they're laid out in the manual, and definitely training them and practicing with them is huge in being able to use it when you have to. So
right. Well, you know, I think that the Kenpo techniques offer something. They do have a lot of principles in Kenpo and in their techniques that do teach us things, but for a viable on the street in use application, I'm just not so sure. And I'm sure that there's a lot of guys that share that view. I think that, again, you just have to train stuff. You have to train it, and you have to train it hard, and you have to train against a realistic thing. Too many people are out there using little wooden guns and all kinds of wacky stuff to train gun techniques when they should actually be using, if not a real gun, something that weighs like a real gun and something that isn't look like a 45, maybe something a little smaller, because guys are carrying stuff that's a little smaller on the street now. So you need to understand that. You need to know how they work. And in the same way with knives, a lot of times you'll see these big giant trainer knives that people are working with and stuff like that. And that's okay. At least it's a start. But then sooner or later, you got to take a 3.5-inch folder and maybe just dull the edge down and take the point off a little bit and practice with something smaller that you would actually see on the street or actually come across on the street, things like that. So again, just real world application type thing. We need to get into that if you want to talk about whether something's viable or not viable or whether it will work with this or that or whatever. That's, again, just my opinion. I could be wrong, but it's worked for me for years and years and years. So,
yeah, no, I agree, especially with the having trainers that are replicas of the real things. Yeah, just, you know, getting the basic motions with the various kind of trainers that are out there. Okay, yeah, you get the foundational pieces, but yeah, to really be able to work these techniques effectively, yeah, we need to have more realistic replicas of the weapons that are going to be out there, because it, you know, it's just like with getting getting, you know, kicked and punched a lot of the schools, especially maybe the earlier days or in various versions of Kenpo or other arts. We do a lot of the air karate, and it's a very different experience when you get hit or when you have to hit something. I have always kind of had a problem with some of these kind of not to single them out, but some of these kind of women's self-defense seminars, and it's just like, okay, well, the guy grabs you and you kick him in the balls and you're good. And there's more to that, more to it than that. And you definitely have to get that experience hitting things and working with a body and getting that understanding of how a body reacts to when you hit it and having your own body, understanding how your own body reacts to punching something or kicking something or you know, elbowing something, things like that. So for those that are interested in the martial arts for the real self-defense applications, I definitely think there needs to be more of a realistic focus on that. And of course, there's only so far you can train it in that way. But I think that there certainly needs to be more schools and more kind of focus on that realistic training and versus just, okay, well, you know, yeah, Kenpo's great and it can solve all the problems. And you have to kind of put it to the test a little bit more than just saying that it's got everything and can do all that. So,
well, you know, you brought up something about self-defense for women and stuff like that. So about, gosh, I don't know how many years ago it was that there was a lawyer down here, and she came home, opened her garage door, pulled in, and the garage door came down. And they wound up finding her body about 3 days later in a canal near her house. Turned out that she was a lawyer and she was representing a woman who was getting a divorce from this guy. And that guy was so pissed off at her that he waited for her. And you could see that there was a struggle in the garage, according to the police, but obviously she didn't win that struggle. And that's what got me into the whole thing about trying to help women in self-defense and doing things like that. I always say that if I could have spent some time with her, maybe I could have gave her the technique she needed to get out alive. Maybe she still would be hurt, but she would maybe be alive. So that's when I started talking about women and self-defense. And I got with Dave Hebler, and he was at that time putting together a whole self-defense for women type thing. And we started playing around with that. But the thing was, is a lot of these things were, they would just let women slap a pad and go, no, no, no. And they would think that's all they need to have for self-defense. Or like you said, kick him in the balls. Well, let me tell you something. I was a bouncer one time. I kicked the guy in the balls and he just looked at me. Okay. It doesn't always work, you know? So you got to make sure you can stun and run for girls. Get the hell out of there. Stun them and go or whatever. And I like to be real hands-on. And a lot of the women that I taught never had been touched like that before. When I grabbed them by the throat and threw them up against the wall, you could see their eyes open up. Nobody had ever done that before. And the thing is, that's the kind of thing you need to train, because otherwise all you're going to do is shut down in fear. But if you've been there before, if you've been in that position, just like jujitsu guys, man, they've been on the bottom and they've been all wrapped up, but that's okay. They stay cool and they do what they got to do. You know, or when the guy's up against the cage in the octagon and he's getting his ass beat, but he stays cool and he winds up reversing it. It's the same way. You got to make sure that you don't just get so scared that you can't react. So I always had a pretty hands-on course for women that ended actually with a little tiny bit of jujitsu, just a little tiny bit. I'm not a jujitsu guy at all. But I used to call it my backseat jujitsu, which was basically just chokes from the bottom rape prevention type of thing and stuff like that. And I wound up being very successful with that. And the women, after they got over the initial fear of being hit and being this and being that, wound up getting to be pretty potent in their work. And that's what I wanted. I wanted them to be potent quick, and I wanted to be able, you know, the stun and run thing, man, hurt somebody hard and then get the hell out of there type of thing. And actually, just recently, I work for Sandra at Seize Kempo now, teaching kids karate. I never thought at 71 years old I'd start be teaching little kids. I never did anything with little kids before. I always wanted adults, never little kids. But we just recently trained a group of seven Jewish girls from the Jewish school. And the problem we had was that because of religious things, I was not allowed to touch them, because they were not allowed to be touched by men until they were married, I guess, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that proved to be kind of interesting. I had to find some women and some girls, their junior black belts and Sandra, who were willing to take a beating a little bit so that these girls could train hard and do what they had to do. And it actually worked out pretty good. These little young girls, they came in and, man, they were just kicking some ass after a while, you know, and they were all 14 and 15. The Jewish school had sent them over to us to try to get them, especially with all the things going on in nowadays with the Jewish thing and all, and the Palestinians and stuff. So I guess they wanted to offer them a little bit of thing, and it worked out pretty well. But like you said, if you don't put them in a real world situation, it's tough for them to really train properly. You can sit there and tell people, oh, just slap them and say no. Well, listen, to some guys, no don't mean no. Mm-hmm. They're going to keep getting you until you do something about it. So
exactly,
that's kind of my mindset about that. And also, speaking of mindset also happens to be one of the things. You could be an average martial artist, but if you got a badass mindset, you can still get your way out of things. And you can be a great martial artist and be a wuss or whatever, or not have the mindset and get your ass kicked. So the mind has got a lot to do with it also, how you train your mind and your mindset going in and out of these type of situations.
I totally agree with that. It reminds me of something that I run into all the time when training and sparring with somebody, or just working techniques, or just working with somebody, and they give they give me a little shot on the lip or the nose or something, or immediately they're like, oh my god, I'm so sorry, and I tell people, unless I'm bleeding or I fall on the ground and start screaming, oh my God, I'm hurt, I'm fine. Let's keep going. Okay, you give me a little tap on the nose, you hit me, something gets through and slaps me. If I'm not falling on the floor, rolling around, I'm fine. Let's keep going.
Right.
I think that goes with that mindset. every strike is this lethal, deadly strike. And it's like, no, we're a little bit more tougher than, and for me, I'm very, very much not a tough guy, but I can take a little shot here and there, and I'll be all right. So,
yeah. Well, you know, there was a book. It's funny you say about taking shots and stuff like that. And that's one of the things, you know, people always say about, why do we hit ourselves and why do we do this and why do we hit? And when this technique lines, we're kicking the crap out of each other and we're doing a lot of stuff. And there was a book years and years ago called Karate for Dummies. And each whatever was broke down. So Taekwondo had a couple of pages about Taekwondo, and Judo had this, and this one had this, and all this had this. And then when they got to American Kempo, it had like one line. It says, if you don't like being hit, this is not for you. And that was it. You know, because we did have a reputation at one time for hitting hard and, you know, and hitting. And, but I think that's good, because I think that, when you're used to it, or you have gotten hit before, when you get that first hit, an altercation just comes in, you listen, sucker punches are going to get in there. I've gotten sucker punched plenty of times. But at least you don't just cower and shrink. You come back and you do what you got to do, and you take care of business, and you make the guy pay for the sucker punch. That's what I like about Kempo, is the hard hitting. The only bad thing is that when you get to be an old fart like me, you can't quite hard hit and hit as hard and get hit as hard as you used to. And I kind of feel bad sometimes that I'm, you know, I can't let the guy tee off on me like I could tee off on the young guy, you know, but I'm on the mat working with guys 20 and 30 and 40 years younger than me. I know those guys can take it a little more than me, but it's still fun, you know?
Very nice. Very nice. I like them. So I wanted to talk more about the teaching side, but and maybe we'll double back to that. I wanted to kind of change gears a little bit. I believe I saw a video of you competing fairly recently, and so I wanted to kind of change gears and talk about the competing side of it. When did you get into that, and what are your kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I used to compete a lot when I was young, in my 20s. And what happened was, I guess, I'll tell you this whole story. I was down there, and I was at the Miami Beach Convention Center, and I was on the main stage, and I was competing for the Grand Championship. And there were five judges, and I was competing against a Nishi Gojiru guy, and this guy was pretty good. Let me tell you something. And we were up there, and we were beating. This was back in the days of no hands, and you know what I mean? It was just bare stuff. So there was lots of blood in these tournaments sometimes, and we were beating the heck out of each other. And the guy that was the main judge, the middle judge, the guy I was fighting was his student, and three of the other four judges were Nishi Gojiru guys. And it got to the point where every time I would score or hit this guy, everybody never saw anything. And then when that guy hit me, everybody saw everything. And it was one of those things. And I mean, I beat the hell out of that guy and lost. Okay. And I was so mad about it that I said, that's it. I'm never going to compete again. That was it. I was done competing. I said, the next time I'm going to compete, it's going to be in a ring kind of thing. And that's when I started doing a little bit of kickboxing, because I figured, you know what? You may beat me, but you're never, you know, you may outpoint me, but you're never going to beat me type of mentality. And that was the last time I had competed. And then I guess it was 40 something years later, Manny Reyes was having his big tournament down in Miami, and he was having the World Kempo Championships. Okay. So there were teams from all over Europe and Canada and all of it. There must have been 17 countries represented, came down to Miami, and they competed, and we competed in self-defense forms and fighting. So I was helping some of the guys, and we were training together, and they says, well, Tony, why don't you compete, man? That's a pretty good form. You could do that. I understand, because I still didn't have my new knees. I still had my bad knees. And they said, why don't you compete? And I said, man, you got to be kidding me. Really? But I did it. I wound up competing in self-defense and in forms, and just for fun. And I wound up getting 2 second places in the 50 and over division. Now, back then I was younger. I was only a young 65 years old then. So I just did it just for fun, because those guys edged me on. And then the next time I did it again, 3 years later, and wound up doing it again. And I probably should have did some sparring, but I was always chicken of my knees, because I had such bad knees, and I was always wondering, man, when these guys whack me one time in the knees or something by accident or whatever, and the party's over. So I never really wanted to do that. I do my share. I get on the mat once a month. I try to get over to Alex's open mat, and we got guys that spar, and I get to spar against some really good guys. And those guys are all very respectful, because you know what? Like I say, I'm 30, 20, 40 years older than most of those guys, and they're good. They could probably whoop my ass anytime. But every once in a while, they let me get a shot in, and we have some time, and I get to get out there and move a little. But anyway, that's what I did. I never had competed again. And then Alex, the one you're probably talking about, a buddy of mine, Alex, that was his tournament. And I just, for support, I decided to go ahead and do a form five with a little bit of modifications because of the knee thing. So I didn't want to go down on my knee for that one technique. And so I changed it a little. But that's what that was all about. And somehow or another, I pulled out a third place. But again, you know, there wasn't that many competitors. Okay. Mm-hmm. There was only about eight or so competitors or something like that. And it wound up being a 40 and over division, because there was two guys in their 40s, and then the rest of the guys, the nearest guy to me was, I think, 56 years old, 15 years younger than me. And then there was me. So even though it is what it is, I'm happy. Even though I love all the comments when they put that on social media, somebody put that form on social media. It was some of the greatest comments, and you know, about, man, this guy should give up. He's too old and this and that and whatever. That's okay. I get it. One guy said, oh, that's probably only a 6 or a 7 at best. And you know what? He was right, because I got all 9 sixes and a couple of 9 sevens. Mm-hmm. So you know what? The guy was right. But my favorite one was they didn't know that Tommy Chong was still practicing karate or something like that. I thought that was pretty funny. So I don't pay attention to that, the comments on that. A lot of the guys, the comments they made, they obviously didn't understand the form.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, too. I don't mind. Listen, come on down to the open mat. I'll get on the mat with anybody. You know what I mean? And then you can make your judgment after that about what I am or this or that or whatever. But that's the only reason I competed again, just was for fun and just to do that. It really wasn't anything serious. I don't compete regularly. It was just one of those things. I just thought, well, let me go out there and do it, support the tournament for my buddy and have some fun. And if I actually win anything, I was really shocked that I even came in, especially being the oldest guy. Because I'll tell you what, the guy that won deserved to win. He did a damn good form, and he was 52 years old, you know? Mm-hmm. So good for him, but it is what it is.
Yeah, no, I like that you're, you know, still willing to get out there, and all those keyboard warriors and that, yeah, it's, they need to go away and, you know, or actually get out there and do something. That's, yeah, I always just laugh at those kind of guys that they have everything to say, but once you turn the right spotlight on them, it's a very, very different story. So
yeah, I think also just the fact that they're probably 30 years younger than me, I always would like to tell them, well, listen, when you get to be 70, let me see if you're still working out, let me see if you're still doing what I'm doing at 70, and if you are, well, then good for you, man, that's great. But, you know, because believe it or not, age does make a difference. I'm not as fast as I used to be. Sometimes I'll look at myself sparring some of these guys. And let me tell you something. I spar this guy named Brian Shawn. This guy is like one of the best old guy fighters in the state. Man, this fucking guy is fast. Man, he's got a back fist. He'll tattoo your face all day long. And he's got great kicks. He's some type of Taekwondo-ish type stylist and stuff like that. I fight against some of those guys, and man, let me tell you something. And I watched the video and I said, Jesus, can I move any slower? You know? And I keep thinking to myself, maybe it's time to just get out of this and retire. But then every once in a while, I sneak a kick in there to the head or something. And I'm saying, well, maybe not yet. You know, I still got one kick left. So, and it's just a good challenge for me to go out there. And this way I don't have to sit there and talk shit and not be able to get out there and prove it. I mean, all the shit that I talk, no problem. Come on the mat. And you can kick my butt, I can kick your butt, we're going to have a good time, and we'll see what happens, and it will be fun.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you're willing to say all these things, you better be ready to back it up, and you're getting out there and backing it up, so.
Yeah, not very good, but at least I'm trying, you know, so, but I have a lot of fun, and I get to work out with some great people. I have worked out with some great people in the past. You know, I trained with Sean Kelly for over just about 20 years, and he had a lot of great camps, and I got to meet a lot of great martial artists, a lot of great grandmasters, Mike Pick, Rainer Schulte, Larry Tatum, all those guys, man, Trejo, a million guys that were legends in their time and stuff like that. And I got to take away a lot of good stuff from them, you know, and it was a good deal. And training under Sean Kelly was good because he improved my tempo. You know, like I said, he always used to tell me, oh, I know you can fight, but do you do this? And so, you know what? It was good. I learned the system of tempo a little bit better. And then I got a mindset from Mike Pick, which was just unbelievable. You know what I mean? It was just a different type of mindset that you've ever heard. If you've never trained with the guy or you've never been in a seminar with him, next time you get a chance to do it. It's pretty interesting. And, you know, Rainer was a good inspiration for me because he was, when I met him, he was 69 years old. And I said to myself, man, I want to be a badass like that when I'm 69. Well, I'm probably not, but I'm pretty damn close. So, you know, I still get out there and have some fun. So, you know, there was a lot of guys that influenced it, the way I trained and stuff like that. And Larry Tatum, of course, man, nobody thinks about Kempo the way Larry does. I mean, he's got some stuff that's so far out there, but it's pretty cool stuff. Not everything's for everybody. So you take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and just do your own thing, you know? And that's what I tell people, even when I train them. I show them all the different variations of what I've learned of a particular technique and tell them, now you got to find your own organic technique, your own technique, your authentic technique, what will work for you. I know what works for me, and I'm going to show you that, and it may work for you, or you may need to adjust it to something different. But that's the way I kind of approach the art when I'm helping somebody along or teaching them.
Yeah, that's one of the beauties of Kempo is that it we are not supposed to be just robot, you know, mirror copies of each other. It's all about tailoring it and customizing it and fitting it to the individual. And we're just not all clones of each other, because techniques that work good for you may not work good for me, and vice versa. And there's so many different body types and experiences and mindsets that it's not a one size fits all sort of system. So
yeah, I mean, and like working with different size people, it makes a big difference. You know, I mean, I can work with people my size all day long and I'm pretty good, but every once in a while I get to work with these big giant guys, and man, oh man, like I work with this one guy, Alfred Magnum, man, you should have him on your podcast if you haven't had it yet, because this guy is just a wealth of martial arts knowledge. You don't have a whole lot of rank, and that don't mean shit anyway. This guy knows a lot about a lot of stuff, and he's good. And man, you work with that guy, and I'll tell you what, he just looks at you and it hurts, okay, because he's so big, you know, but he moves like a 170-pound guy, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's got great movement, and he hits, and he knows the system, and he knows not only the system, but he's trained in a lot of systems. That's a guy you might want to think about, too. He'll give you a good interview, but you work with different sized people also, and it teaches you how to adjust your Kempo to different situations, and that's why it's not written in stone. Can't be written in stone. Too many people, you get into a, you know what I like, when you get into a technique line and somebody throws the wrong punch and the guy that's doing the technique is completely baffled. Mm-hmm. He doesn't react at all. You got to be able to just go ahead and do something, you know, fight with your art, not let your art fight for you. You know, you got to learn how to use your art in a situation and not get stuck in the techniques of you know, how we teach it. I mean, everybody goes, okay, do delayed sword or whatever the heck it is. And man, all of a sudden the left comes at him and they're doing delayed sword. And I says, well, no, don't, just react. Just do something different. You know, you don't, it's not set in stone that you got to do this or this or this, you know? And that's one of the things I like about Kempo, is that we can do it any way we want and we can tailor it, like you said, to any body style or strength or attribute that the student has.
Exactly. I like it. So we've got so many other things, and we're definitely gonna have to do multiple parts. As I think I tell every guest I have, that's one of the things that I just love about Kempo and the martial arts. I mean, we could talk this stuff all the live long day, but
all day.
So we're gonna go ahead and move into our lightning round here. Got a few questions to kind of wrap it up, and then we'll kind of go from there. But the first question: do you have a favorite technique?
I kind of like snapping twig. I don't know why, but I kind of like snapping twig. I, of course, everybody loves five swords, and I like to do a snapping twig into a five swords type of thing. That's always a lot of fun. But I think any of the techniques we have that explode right from the start, which I guess all of them could do that. But those are two of my favorites.
Very nice. Yeah, no, I like it. They're part of what I call the Kempo All-Star techniques, that techniques that seem to exist in every version of Kempo, or at least every version that I've I've been exposed to, but yeah, your five sword, just snapping twigs, or thundering hammers,
thundering hammer.
Kind of everywhere. So I like it. Very nice. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Yeah, my favorite form is actually form four. Normally I do form five when I've done the tournaments because it's a little shorter, but actually my favorite form is form four. I just like the way it flows. I just like it.
Very nice. Well, you can do the short version of, form four.
Form four. So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's a nice one. I like it. I like it. Right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Yeah, I like messing with knives. Okay, I like the knife, the way you can do knife stuff, and there's a lot of different things. Mike Pick teaches an awesome knife class, and his mindset on that will change the way you think about the knife. But yeah, the knife is probably my favorite weapon. It's up close and personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Mike Pick is the man to go to about knife stuff, for sure. I have not yet, had a chance to train with him or learn from him, but, I'm definitely, seeking that out and hope to get some time with him, in the future. So, very nice. Right. Next question. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Well, I guess I would have liked to have spent some time with Larry Tatum before I got to where I am. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have been a little bit different. I like the way Larry. Sometimes some of the stuff, what he says is so far out there. And I'm not saying this in a disparaging way. I'm saying this about, he thinks of stuff that I would have never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I says, that's just not the way my mind thinks. And so I think that's pretty good. I would have liked to have spent more time with Mr. Pick, discussing stuff, his hardcore way of doing Kempo, not even talking about the knife. I'm just talking about the techniques.
Mm-hmm.
is interesting, to say the least, and hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two guys that I wouldn't mind training a lot with. And then there's probably, I'd love to get Chuck Norris on the mat one time.
Oh yeah,
kick his ass a little bit.
don't let him hear that.
That's all right. I met him once, me and Linda met him once a long time ago. He was a very gracious and very nice person. And, you know, I just liked the guy. I wouldn't mind spending some time. And no, I understand everybody probably want to spend some time with Bruce Lee, and maybe so. But I'm not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just don't know. Not that I dislike anything he does. I just don't know if that would have been for me.
Yeah.
What he was doing at the time, the way he trained and stuff. I don't know. But that's just the way that is. He was still an actor, mm-hmm. and so was Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
But at least Chuck competed a little bit.
Yeah.
And he was in the military, and he did do some things like that. So I got to respect that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I like it. I like it. All right. So this last question, I'm still kind of working on how to formulate this, but what is something that inspires you? So I'm going to kind of lay out how I have this envisioned in my mind. So for me, the movie Rocky IV, they've got the training montage, and he's out there running in the snow and chopping the wood and lifting the rocks and everything. And the song is playing, and it's like, I've seen that movie so many times, and every single time I watch it, and I get to that scene, I'm ready to get out and train. I'm like, okay, now it's time for me to go out there and just put in some work. So, I'm curious if the something that just always motivate you, and it can be anything, a movie, a song, a book, a person, anything that just always gets you, you know, motivated to train. What would be something that, you know, provides you that inspiration, that to quote the water boy, the tackling fuel. what is something like that for you?
Well, you know, that's funny you mentioned that, because every time I see that scene where he's lifting the rocks and lifting shit and doing old school against, and it shows Drago doing the scientific new school and all that stuff, that scene does get you fired up. I mean, how can it not? Mm-hmm. Man, you want to go out and just kick some ass after that scene. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's pretty good too. There's so many different scenes in so many different movies that, you know, it's hard to tell, but like that one there is a good one. Best of the best movie. I love when the girl sits down and she starts talking about, you know, winning is a habit, so is losing, or, you know, yeah. And she gives that whole thing, and she says that's a Vince Lombardi quote, which after that movie, I went out and bought that poster, and it's still in my office.
Oh, nice.
About, you know, winning is a habit, and so is losing, you know, and I think that's kind of cool, because you have to get out there and you have to train hard if you want to be a winner. So I think stuff like that can make you do that also. And I'm not sure if there's any other ones. Well, you know, you get off of that, but just motivation, period. I love Rudy.
Oh, yes.
You know, here's a little guy with no skill. And man, there's me right there, a little guy with no fucking skill. But if you got heart, you can still win. And a lot of that goes back to the mindset we were talking about. You could be an average martial artist, but if you got heart, if you got a good mindset, you can still beat the guy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of think that that's kind of motivating also. And then there's also that guy, David Goggins. Have you seen any of his stuff yet? This guy was
familiar.
He was a big giant fatso, and he wanted to join the Navy SEALs, and he tried like three times before he finally got through. And this guy is an animal, and he tells a lot of great stories about how to get motivated and stuff like that. I think that guy's pretty motivational also. And then, you know what else that motivates me? Seeing other old guys out there that are badass as shit, okay? And I see them out there, and I says, fuck, man, that's what I want to be. I want to be badass like that dude, you know, even though I'm an old fart too. You know, I just think that that's cool when you see good old guys. I'm not talking about like me, but I'm talking about guys that are just badass old guys, you know. I think that that's so cool to watch those guys and how they carry themselves and how they get into it and things like that. And those guys kind of inspire me also.
No, I agree. I agree totally on that. One of the arts that I do capoeira, and in the capoeira world, that there are a number of 70 plus guys that are getting out there and moving like you wouldn't believe. And I see them doing their thing, and I'm just like, what? I'm getting off the couch, and I'm going to put in some work, because if this guy's getting out there and doing it, I have no excuse to be, oh well, I'm hurt, you know, I hurt my toe or something. No, like I can get out there. they're getting out there. I can get out there too. So I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
And that's the way I feel about like me being old too. I mean, I kind of hope that I'm inspiring somebody to get off their ass, and if I can do it, you can do it. Type thing, you know what I mean? Get out there. It's never too late. It's, you know, you're never too old, even just to get out there and move a little bit. You know, no one says you got to get out there and be Bruce Lee, but just get out there and move, and, you know, get some quality in your life back with a good physical. I mean, the only reason, I'm 71 years old. My father died when he was 46. My brother died when he was 40, and my mother died when she was my age, of 70. So all from heart problems, and that's why I think either the karate and the martial arts has kept me healthy and allowed me to live a pretty good life, because right now, basically, I'm in pretty good shape for an old guy. I don't take really any medications for anything, only some Advil every now and then and some Jack Daniels. And I'm hoping that I can inspire other guys. I mean, I got a lot of friends of mine that, you know, I outlived them. They're dead. you know, and they retired, they became couch potatoes, they stopped moving, and then their health went down. So I'm just hoping that maybe somebody sees me and goes, well, if Capone can get his old ass out there, then I can get mine out there, you know, and that's kind of why I do what I do also, you know, so.
Yep. No, to quote another movie, Shawshank Redemption, said, get busy living or get busy dying. So, yeah, you got to get out there and move or it's the end for you. So I like it. I like it. Yep. All right. So now we are at our point for a shameless self-promotion. So you can go ahead and plug anything you'd like, or if there's anything that we didn't cover that you want to make sure that we get out today, you have the floor. You can say whatever you'd like, and then we'll kind of close out from there.
Okay. Well, I really don't have anything to self-promote. You know, I still go, Sandra gave me a job teaching kids, which was really fun. It started with just teaching her and her staff. And now I'm teaching kids, which I never thought I would do. And it's a lot of fun, but I really have nothing to promote for myself, except to just tell people, just get out there and do it and have fun and enjoy life. You know what I mean? That's it. That's all there is, you know, just enjoy it. So while you got it, do it, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, yes, I thank you so much for taking the time to share your story with me and the listeners. We had a few little technical difficulties, so I'll have fun trying to edit that all up, but we'll make it work. We'll definitely have to do this again and get into more stories and more of your journey. But once again, I thank you so much for being on, and can't wait to get this together for everyone to hear.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.